It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this half hour, NPR political reporter Danielle Kurtzleben. Danielle is the keynote speaker today at the Iowa Women's Foundation annual luncheon, and that's why we recorded my conversation with her earlier today. Welcome, Danielle.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Great to be with you. I was happy to see that in your bio that you're a native Iowan of Titonka.
Yep.
Titonka. We'll talk about that a little bit later, hopefully. First of all, let's get to the politics. New polling showing that the Democratic enthusiasm advantage has defined this campaign up to this point has evaporated a bit, according to a new NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll. Back in July, a 10-point gap between the number of Democrats and Republicans saying the November elections were very important. Now down to 2 points. What do you see in these numbers?
Well, one thing I do want to say, and I don't want to throw cold water on everything right away, but I mean, it is true that it's always that when you have just one poll in front of you, you don't want to, you know, absolutely throw out everything you've been thinking and change everything you've been thinking based on one poll. That said, I mean, this is our poll and we do a good job of it. So, you know, if the enthusiasm gap really has slipped this much, the question is why. Mm-hmm. And I mean, one thing that we've been talking about at on our team, the politics team at NPR, is like, it's possible that, for example, the Brett Kavanaugh, Christine Blasey Ford controversy has driven enthusiasm up among Republicans. And you can see why, right? I mean, you have Donald Trump getting out there and being really quite angry about this, saying that, for example, Brett Kavanaugh's life is being ruined. I'm paraphrasing here, but saying that Brett Kavanaugh's life is being ruined over these accusations and that sort of thing. And so Donald Trump has a very, very incredible ability to really lead his base and really sort of drive enthusiasm, drive feelings among his base. So to the degree that he is whipping up anger surrounding this, it is possible that that is driving up enthusiasm. Then again, once again, it's really hard to know the why behind poll numbers. All we know is the what.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to believe because everything is going so quickly. It was 1 week ago that testimony took place. Christine Blasey Ford and Brett Kavanaugh. That's amazing.
I know. I was saying to some coworkers recently, like, remember when that anonymous op-ed came out in the New York Times?
History.
Was that like a decade ago? That right. Feels like it. Yeah.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about this. Within the past week, the president has gone from saying Christine Blasey Ford is, quote, very credible,
right,
quote, very compelling, to at a rally Tuesday of this week in Mississippi, mocking her, making fun of her not being able to remember certain details in the alleged assault on her by Brett Kavanaugh when she was 15. So what do you make of this about shift? This is a strategic decision by the president. And is it shared by the rest of the GOP leadership?
It's certainly not shared by key senators, right? I mean, Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, Susan Collins from Maine, they are two key votes that everyone is watching right now on the Kavanaugh confirmation. And they both came out and said, essentially, that is unacceptable what Donald Trump said. Like, they are very upset. So to the degree that he has upset some Republican senators, that could really endanger Brett Kavanaugh's nomination. Now, as far as how strategic it was, I mean, one thing you can say about watching the opponents of Brett Kavanaugh narrative that's out there and versus the Republican narrative, what Donald Trump seems to be saying, regardless of the mocking, when he says things like, think of your sons, think of the men in your life, think of what could happen if they were falsely accused, he seems to be saying, he's making the men the protagonist. He's saying, here is the storyline. Put yourself in Brett Kavanaugh's shoes. Meanwhile, I mean, it's a very simple contrast. Democrats are saying, put yourself in Christine Blasey Ford's shoes. There was an ad that recently came out. I was watching it with my editor the other day. It's a bunch of women, all colors, all ages, sitting, looking at their phones, looking at televisions, their computers, watching the Blasey Ford testimony. And they don't really say anything, but the message is clear. The message is, think of your daughters, think of the women in your life, or put yourself in their shoes. This idea of not being believed when you come forward with something like this. So It's very much a who's the protagonist thing that seems to be happening right now.
Right. And Donald Trump bringing in here not just Brett Kavanaugh as a protagonist, but pulling in also to do with gender, the fact that he's claiming this is destroying a family. He has a wife and he has two young girls.
Correct. Yes. And Brett Kavanaugh made women before even Christine Blasey Ford came into this. Brett Kavanaugh, you'll remember, made women such a central part of his testimony, right? Talking about his daughters, their basketball team, helping with their basketball team, talking about his wife, talking about promoting women to clerkships. So Brett Kavanaugh already was making gender a big part of this, saying, yes, I am a champion of women.
Mm-hmm. To what extent does Brett Kavanaugh's reaction to the accusations mirror the reaction that Donald Trump has had to accusations by multiple women against him?
I mean, heavily.
Heavily. It's a mirror image.
I mean, it's on a basic level, they're both denying any of the accusations against them. Donald Trump has had more than a dozen women accuse him of some form of misconduct over time. He has denied all of it. Likewise, Brett Kavanaugh has a few of these accusers right now. He denies all of it as well. But it's bigger than that. It's not just that. There is anger and indignation behind it. Donald Trump comes out and says not only, no, I didn't do this, but he says it angrily. He gets up at a podium and he yells and the crowd cheers for him. Brett Kavanaugh, he wasn't up in front of a crowd, but he was up in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And he really had this very strong tone of indignation, the sense of, how dare you? You're really, really ruining my life here. And I cannot believe this is happening.
Right. But there was a line there that some would say was crossed in terms of his demeanor, going from indignation and anger about this accusation, which some people can understand, to a partisan attack on the Democrats, right? And something even going back to the 2016 election.
Right. Well, not just the 2016 election. He brought in the Clintons. I mean, and when people reference the Clintons, he's not just talking about 2016.
Right.
People are talking about, you know, the 90s. But this brings up something really interesting about Supreme Court nominations. There has been this sense, it's a very Washington-flavored politeness surrounding Supreme Court nominations, right? Or not just politeness. I mean, it is an established norm in Washington. And what we're seeing here is how strong people feel it is surrounding Supreme Court nominations being somehow apolitical, even if a partisan person is making the nomination.
It's a little bit of a facade, right?
It has
always been, perhaps.
Perhaps, but not necessarily. I mean, the fact that you have some of these justices who are controversial today, but who were still confirmed with 90-some votes in the Senate. Mm-hmm. I mean, senators in the past had come together quite strongly to confirm some of these justices, and that just doesn't seem to happen as much anymore. We are seeing some of that slipping, and I don't know if it necessarily was a facade, but to the degree that it was, it's crumbling.
Mm. If you just joined us, my guest is NPR political reporter Danielle Kurtzleben, a native Iowan. We'll talk about that in just a moment. She is speaking before the Iowa Women's Foundation, keynote speaker at their annual luncheon. I'd like to get your views, Danielle, on how people tend to see this in terms of gender or party politics, the Kavanaugh battle. When we look at people's gender, do they tend to identify as a male or a female, or in terms of which party they feel an allegiance to?
Much more partisan. When you look at Republican women and men, how they feel about Brett Kavanaugh, they are much more aligned with each other than, say, Republican women are with Democratic women. It's not that all women feel the same way. It's not that all men feel the same way. But partisanship and gender are hard to disentangle. I mean, women are more likely to be Democrats than they are to be Republicans. So gender and party do sort of go hand in hand to a certain degree.
Mm-hmm. What about within the parties? How gender, perhaps more generally, not just to do with the Kavanaugh battle, but how gender is being dealt with in this midterm campaign within each of the parties? We know this is the so-called year of the woman, if for the Democrats, at least.
Right. It's much more of a Democratic thing.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And more female candidates for congressional positions than, what, ever before?
Yeah, although I will point one thing out here, which is there are plenty of advocates of women in government who would take issue with you saying year of the woman. Their whole thing is that it's not just one year, that they hope that this continues in both parties. So if you're an advocate of gender equality, it may not just be one year. But yeah, I mean, look, the way that the different parties deal with gender, I mean, one simple way to think of it is that Democrats deal with gender more than Republicans. And that is not a slam or that is not an appraisal of either party. That's just kind of true. You see, Democratic voters are more likely to say women in office is an inherently good thing, that there is something inherently good about having, you know, a more diverse group of people in the legislature, that there is inherent value to having a woman in office. Republicans, when I interview them and when you look at polls, they say, no, I just want someone who's qualified. It's gender blind. It's race blind. That doesn't matter. It doesn't even enter into my head. So the two parties have very fundamentally different philosophies about this. And so, and I even see this out on the campaign trail. It's not just women Democrats who tell me, yeah, I'm excited about women. I have had plenty of men Democrats tell me, you know, I want to see more women in office. But the question is why that is. Some of it is that people see women, and this is especially on the Democratic side, see women as better at, you know, those so-called working family issues, better on issues like paid leave or, you know, taking care of health care and making kids have health care and that sort of thing. But one other key thing this year is Democrats really, really want to throw the bums out, right? Because Congress is Republican controlled. So women, as pollsters have been telling me, women are seen as change agents just because they are not very common in Congress. When voters see a woman candidate, especially Democratic voters this year, they are more likely to think, you know what? That is a change person. That is someone who's going to be different. I want to vote that person in.
You are a native Iowan. You have to be tuned into the Iowa races here, I would imagine, as a political reporter.
I am.
We have interesting gender mixes here in our races. Governor Kim Reynolds versus Fred Hubble. Rod Blum in the 1st District facing Abby Finkenauer, and David Young in the 3rd District facing the challenger Cindy Axne.
Right.
What do you find interesting about any of these races?
I mean, let's start with the Abby Finkenauer-Rod Blum race. Abby Finkenauer is very young. I mean, she's not just unusual because she's a woman, and Iowa has not sent many women to Congress.
28 or something, right?
I believe the only woman Iowa has sent to Congress is Joni Ernst.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, she was the very first.
Yeah, so lo and behold, you could have numbers 2 and 3 coming out right now. And yeah, Abby Finkenauer is 28. She would be among the youngest members of Congress. She's part of this crop of millennial-ish women who are running for office this year. You know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in New York, Lauren Underwood in Illinois. You have a whole bunch of these women. So Abby Finkenauer is part of a sort of wave of young women, not just women running for office. So watching her run as a young woman in a state that is a little on the older side and that has tended to send men to Congress, that's really fascinating. And I'm interested in seeing how she does. As far as the governor's race, that's also a fascinating race just because it flips the gender dynamics of this year on its head. You have a Republican woman and a Republican woman incumbent governor. Women governors are still pretty rare in America. So we're watching her defend her seat against a Democratic man. And so we'll see how much her incumbency advantage really sticks with her, especially since, you know, Democrats, yes, they do tend to like women candidates this year, but they're not going to cross party lines just to vote for a woman. That's not how this works.
I guess the question, too, is will Iowa Democrats talk about the blue wave? And, okay, we see that in the light of this one new NPR poll.
Right.
Perhaps a small little wave on the shore, perhaps a bigger wave. We'll see in less than a month time. But the degree to which you see that Iowa would be part of the blue wave hoped for by Democrats?
I mean, quite possibly. I mean, one interesting thing, though, is, you know, Fred Hubble, for example, he's not a super progressive person. One sort of feature of this blue wave is you have some candidates among Democrats who are quite far left. And Fred Hubble seems to be a little bit more on the moderate side. And so insofar as Iowa is part of this blue wave, it doesn't sort of have every feature of it going for it right now, you know?
Right. And Fred Hubbell being attacked, interestingly, as a well-heeled white man.
Right.
Right? Which we're not used to hearing as an attack on a Democrat.
Right, yeah. And I mean, one other just sort of big picture thing about Iowa politics is that, you know, Iowa had this reputation, has this reputation for a long time of having been a, you know, a kind of purple state. It went for Obama, for example. So then when, you know, it went for Donald Trump in 2016, it sort of, I think, made everybody stand up straight or sort of step back and go, huh, is Iowa turning red? And I think this year is one year where we look at it and we see how purple is Iowa right now, how red is Iowa right now.
Mm-hmm. Comment on Joni Ernst. She's not up for re-election. I believe 2020 is when she'll be up.
Right.
What are your thoughts on how she has dealt with her gender as a candidate and and also now as a U.S. senator, also very much involved in the Brett Kavanaugh battle?
Right. So Joni Ernst, I mean, thinking back to when she was running for Senate, I mean, the thing that stands out, I think, to a lot of people was that ad, and you're nodding, and I know we're both thinking of the same
yes.
thing, the ad about castrating pigs, you know? I mean, and not only that, but she also leaned on, as many candidates do, on her military service, you know? She is a woman, but she also seemed to be sending a message, as many women veterans do, that I'm a woman, but I am tough. Here are my bona fides. Here is what makes me tough. And that toughness is what's going to make me be able to stand up to, you know, those people in Washington, those lobbyists, those incumbents, those this, those that. That's sort of her thing.
Right. Past the pig commercial, we had her hopping on a motorcycle and
yes.
driving to a shooting range.
Right. Yeah.
So there's tough.
Yeah. Now that
the image of tough.
Right. Exactly. So, yeah, that's definitely sort of an image she is trying to project. And you've seen other women this year doing that, too. Martha McSally, for example, in Arizona. It's a thing that some women candidates do. Now, that said, Joni Ernst has also partnered with Marco Rubio on paid leave legislation. So, I mean, like, Joni Ernst is also, you know, championing issues that wrongly, I would say, are called women's issues. But she's, you know, it's not that she's just sticking to this line of, you know, I'm tough and blahzy blah. She's also, like, you know, saying I'm also standing up for families seems to be a part of her image. And let's not be cynical here. I mean, I'm not saying she's not being sincere about this. This is definitely a big issue, trying to get paid leave for families.
Mm-hmm. How has that evolved over the years, the way women candidates run? Also there with Joni Ernst, I think I'm getting her tagline for her campaign right when she, maybe the order is wrong, but soldier, mother, conservative. These were three words she described herself with, if I'm remembering that correctly. Has that evolved? I mean, how do women candidates tend to deal with their gender, or is there a successful recipe now for it? Or does that depend on the year?
It depends on the year. It depends on the state. It depends on so much. I mean, one place to look is Hillary Clinton, though. I mean, she's sort of the ultimate example of this. She ran in 2008, and when she ran in 2008, she had a much more restrained approach to her gender, I think is fair to say. You know, she just got out there and she talked about the issues, but you look and she talked about national security, especially she talked about healthcare, but she didn't run so much on, you know, what she tended to run on in 2016, which is the glass ceiling. I am a grandmother. And she really seemed to lean into that more in 2016. So she is one example of how it's changed. But once again, it depends on the district. It is interesting that you bring up Joni Ernst's tagline. That's especially the soldier and mother aspects of that. Because a story that I just put out for NPR, I went out and I looked at another military veteran, Amy McGrath. She's a Democrat running in Kentucky. And she's a Marine veteran, but in her ads, yes, she has one ad where she's in front of a fighter jet and she's talking about her, you know, her toughness and how hard she worked. And then the next ad I remember I saw from her is her loading her kids into the family car and taking them to the doctor. I mean, and of course, every woman, every candidate of any gender has their different sides to them. But what women seem to be doing, especially some of these veterans, is saying, yes, I am tough, but also voters can't necessarily relate to a fighter pilot or someone who is in the National Guard or what have you, but they can relate to someone who has kids. And women, I think this year especially are really leaning into that and deciding, you know, it's okay to say I'm a mom and even that motherhood is a qualification. I've had voters tell me, yeah, you know what? I really like that candidate X is a mom. It really makes me feel like I know her.
Mm-hmm. A couple minutes left with Danielle Kurtzleben. You are from Iowa. You are an NPR. You're based in Washington, NPR political reporter now. You're from Iowa. You make a big deal, and why not, of being from Titonka. This is a town in Kossuth County. This is in the north part of the state.
Mm-hmm.
Population of less than 500. You're very proud of it. In fact, I saw on your Twitter that you have a map of Titonka featured on your Twitter.
Well, Titonka is my Twitter handle, and I latched onto it before I was even a journalist. And I almost feel a little bad because I didn't really think anything of it. I don't know if the town of Titonka wants it back or wants it for themselves. It's not like I took it from them, but... Yeah, I mean, sorry, Titonka.
Why sorry?
It's mine now.
You helped them put Titonka on the map, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely true, yes. Yeah.
Tell us, give us a growing up in Titonka memory. What was it like?
Well, so I didn't grow up in Titonka. I grew up in the outlying areas. I grew up on a farm outside of Titonka. And maybe one very strong memory that I was thinking of is not so much Titonka, but it was of raising pigs and taking them to the fair with my dad and my sisters. And I mean, it is the most quintessentially Iowa memory.
Really?
But yeah, no, like it's, you know, at parties or whatever, like the most Iowa thing I can tell people is I have trophies in my parents' house that have pigs on top of them. Like it helps me feel like I stand apart at least a little bit in, you know, in Washington, D.C., where very few people have pig trophies at home. But
you've got your authentic American street cred.
I mean, the whole like BS that there is about there being a real America or not, it's just sort of me playing into that, to be honest, I guess. I don't know.
Danielle Kurtzleben, thank you so much for being with us. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Yeah, thank you.
Coming up after a short break, we'll listen to a longer version of an interview that my colleague Clay Masters did with Democratic candidate for governor Fred Hubbell. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Thank you.